Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's long phone chat with Vladimir Putin last Friday, in which Donald Trump did not bring up the issue of Russian interference in our past and future elections, and instead celebrated with Putin what Trump is calling the end of the Russia hoax. That is, the way that the Attorney General Barr and the Republicans have managed to obscure what is actually in the Mueller report, as well as accepting Putin's assurances that Russia has no interest in Venezuela. Dr. Michael Carpenter, a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, who also served as director for Russia at the National Security Council and is now a senior director at the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us. We'll assess whether Trump is naive or compromised, and although he is claiming exoneration and chanting no collusion, there is plenty of evidence in the Mueller report of Russian efforts at coordination and conspiracy in helping elect Trump and defeat Hillary Clinton, which the Republicans are willfully ignoring, and we will speculate why. Then, with Trump coming to the defense of conspiracy theorists who have been banned from Facebook, we will speak with Anna Merlin, a reporter at the Special Projects Desk, the investigative division of Gizmodo Media Group, and author of the new book just out, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. She joins us to discuss how much the conspiracy theorist-in-chief, Donald Trump, is helping propagate sick lies while defending disinformation hucksters like Alex Jones and Paul Joseph Watson, who perpetuate the Sandy Hook, Seth Rich, 9/11, and chemtrails conspiracies. Then finally, we look into the elections for the EU Parliament coming up on May the 23rd and examine the rise of Nigel Farage's new Brexit party in the polls, which is running ahead of Labour and the governing Conservatives. Harold Clark, the co-investigator of the British election study at the University of Manchester and author of Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union, joins us to discuss how the EU elections will likely put an end to Theresa May's government, but also could give far-right parties veto power if they reach a one-third threshold of votes. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. And prior to that, he was a career foreign service officer with the State Department, and he's now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Well, thank you. And what did you make of the phone call that Donald Trump had with Vladimir Putin last week? We only know about it because of White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders' reports on it. And he was asked, Trump was asked by reporters a couple of questions, one of which was, did you talk about Russia's interference in our elections, either the previous ones or the future ones? And President Trump said no. So let's start with the fact that all of Trump's previous meetings with Putin have never been on the public record. They haven't had note takers. So we don't know what they've discussed in private when they have met in person. Are we any better off in terms of what – is there a readout of this conversation anywhere?
No. The typical White House modus operandi following a call between the president and a foreign leader – in all past administrations, at least over the last three or four or five administrations, has been to put out a one-paragraph or two-paragraph readouts of the main topics that the leaders discussed and more or less whether there were any agreements or disagreements on those issues. So the public had a sense of sort of where the conversation went. And, of course, not every single issue made it into those readouts, but nevertheless there was some transparency. And that is lacking, has been lacking with this administration since the start. They sort of picked up where the previous Obama administration left off. I think the career civil servants were still in the habit of issuing readouts, but that has fallen away. And so nothing like that was given this time. But I think more fundamentally, we'll never really know what was said in this call unless somehow it's leaked from inside the White House. But I don't expect that at all.
Well, President Trump did tweet out that he had a good conversation, and they talked about the so-called witch hunt, which apparently they both agreed. I believe Putin, it said, the Mueller report started out as a mountain and ended up as a mouse. But that is not the reality of the Mueller report, even in its redacted version.
Well, so there's two things that really stand out about this call that are just shocking, or should be shocking for most Americans. First is that, as you say, President Trump and President Putin agreed that the investigation was a witch hunt and that the Russia's interference in our 2016 presidential election was a hoax, which is absurd. It's a repeat of the lines that Trump delivered at the Helsinki meeting with President Putin over a year ago, and it's just simply false. Everyone in Trump's administration, from John Bolton to Mike Pompeo to Gina Haspel, everyone, Dan Coats, they have all said on the record multiple times that, yes, Russia did intervene in the 2016 election. They've spun it a number of different ways as perhaps not so consequential, this, that, or the other, but they have all agreed on those basic facts, which are indisputable, and they've been cataloged by our intelligence agencies. And so to have Trump yet again go out there in the public domain and agree with Putin that the whole thing was just a hoax, I mean, it's crazy. It is, it's clearly for a purpose, but it should be troubling to all Americans. And then, you know, the second thing that's really troubling is the response to Russia's intervention in Venezuela. Both its the military advisors and the military intelligence agents that Russia has sent to Venezuela, but also the material and the financial support that they've provided. Basically, Trump portrayed Russia's intervention in Venezuela as much ado about nothing and said, you know, they're on the same side as us. We want to agree on how to make the situation better. Putin's intentions are basically the same as the United States's, which is absurd. Particularly when just only a few days earlier you had both Bolton and Pompeo blasting Russia for its interference, with Pompeo accusing Russia of having convinced Maduro, who was on his way to the airport, to flee the country to actually stay at Russia's behest, and, you know, issuing statements that this is our hemisphere and Russia should get out. Well, it's, you know, that was bluffing on the part of both Pompeo and Bolton, and their bluff has been called. But then you have the president completely reverse course and side with Putin and suggests that, you know, we're really on the same page here. It's absurd.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. He's now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. So how do we then speculate, or how do we figure out what is going on with Donald Trump vis-a-vis Putin? Is Trump naive, or is he compromised?
No, I think clearly that Putin has something on Trump, and Trump is playing out the script that they've agreed that he will play out. First of all, the president is not stupid. He is very crafty and cunning when he needs to be, and clearly his messaging is very consistent on the matter of Russia. And so it's not as if he's naive that Putin wants the same end goal in Venezuela as we do. He clearly knows that's not the case. He has backed his senior advisors, Bolton and Pompeo, in taking a tough stand on Maduro in Venezuela and calling for his ouster. So I don't think that this is improvisation. I don't think it's naivete. I don't think it's stupidity. I think it's very consciously playing to a script that he knows Putin wants to hear. And, you know, I can only say that, you know, I believe the president is compromised. And, you know, we can get into the specifics of that and what the Mueller report found and didn't find. But clearly he is compromised in some way in the simple sense that he is departing from the script of his key advisors and is siding with Putin over his Secretary of State and over his National Security Advisor.
Well, I think Venezuelan socialism in the form of Maduro, which is the country's falling apart. I mean, it's more about corruption than socialism, but he's using that as a model to bash Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, is he not?
Well, they are rhetorically. Of course, the defining feature of the Venezuelan political regime is its authoritarianism. Right. You can use the word socialism to describe it because it's authoritarianism on the left, but that's just sort of a political play that that these, you know, the White House is using to try to tar some of its opponents. In reality, it is a corrupt authoritarian regime, a kleptocratic one, very corrupt, as you say, and certainly the U.S. should be seeking a change of regime. I think not actively, not militarily, but it's to our advantage to have Maduro step aside, ideally through a peaceful democratic process. But so, you know, there's a bit of posturing here. But what's striking again with this phone call with Putin is that Putin has an interest in propping up corrupt authoritarian dictators around the world because that's what he is. And so whether it's Assad in Syria or whether it's some of the strongmen in Central Asia, or the South Caucasus, Putin has an interest in perpetuating regimes that are corrupt oligarchies, like Russia's regime is. And so to have, you know, Trump suggesting that Putin's goals in Venezuela align with ours is just, it's astounding. Undercuts his own message, too.
Well, Dr. Carpenter, though, you know, one of the amazing things about Trump is, I mean, he's been clever in using that word collusion, which doesn't apply to the law. The Mueller report in Volume 1 about Russia and Trump and their contacts is about coordination and conspiracy. Those are the legal terms. And there's quite a lot of evidence in there. But I think he was clever in using the word collusion, and knowing the KGB as you do, or its successor agencies, Trump would be more in the category of what they called a trusted contact, or even a useful idiot, in as much as in the KGB's handbook, General Kryuchkov's handbook, one of the instructions to KGB officers is never leave your fingerprints on a loose cannon. So Trump, you know, went there in 87 on the Soviet dime. He's been getting most of his money from Russians. Russian gangsters started buying condos in Trump Tower and other Trump properties starting in the mid-1980s. And much of that was laundering money stolen by the KGB from the Soviet coffers as it collapsed. And it's an extraordinary story, which had been written about in a number of very, very good books written by very solid journalists like Seth Hettner of the Associated Press and Greg Miller of the Washington Post. So
yeah, Craig Unger
as well did a very good book. It's all documented. It drives me nuts. None of this, of course, was in Mueller's writ, but the history's there. So what is wrong with this? Why can't we look at the full big picture here?
Yeah, well, I think the reason is because Mueller's remit was a very narrow remit to criminally prosecute persons accused of committing crimes in the United States. And he didn't have the evidence to be able to, or according to him, he didn't have the evidence to be able to bring those charges against Trump or members of his team. Now, it's important for the public at large to know that counterintelligence investigations are always tricky. It's usually very difficult, if not impossible, to bring evidence to bear. As good as our intelligence apparatus is, because the other side is obviously trying to hide these communications and is trying to hide any sort of fingerprints that would indicate that there are aspects of collusion or cooperation, if you will, between the two sides. And so think about this little data point that's found in the report. We know that Rick Gates, who is Paul Manafort's deputy, passed to a known person with ties to the Russian intelligence services, a guy named Konstantin Kalimnik. We know that Gates passed to Kalimnik on multiple occasions detailed polling data that was proprietary to the campaign. This was passed to the Russians on an app that deletes the message history as soon as it's sent. Again, as I said, on multiple occasions. And the reason, when asked by Mueller, the reason that Gates gave was that he thought Manafort wanted to send this information to make himself look good. Well, that's clearly absurd on its face. I mean, if you want to make yourself look good, you send up an article from the New York Times that says, you know, Trump campaign manager doing fantastic job or something along those lines. You don't send gigabits of data, detailed data on polling analysis through Excel spreadsheets to some oligarch friend to make yourself look good. You just, it just doesn't happen. It's clearly ridiculous. So why did it happen? Well, in all likelihood, this was part of the collusion, cooperation, whatever you want to call it, that allowed the Russian intelligence services to micro-target the disinformation that they were churning out against Hillary Clinton and in favor of Donald Trump. But we can't prove it because we don't know what happened on the back end. Our intelligence apparatus is not able to determine conclusively what happened with that polling data. Again, it was passed on an app where the messages were deleted instantaneously as soon as they were sent. So this is the problem with counterintelligence investigations. They're often useful in terms of uncovering what a foreign adversary might be up to, but they don't always provide that level of evidence that is required to bring criminal charges. And that's the case here.
Well, but the counterintelligence investigation into Trump and the Russians is still continuing. And and given what Barr has been doing lately, I don't know how much he can stymie that. But just to follow up on the point that you just made, Dr. Michael Carpenter, what we do know about the micro-targeting, and it seems as if you can connect the dots here, Manafort sends the latest polling information through the Russians. The Internet Research Agency, owned by Putin's cook Prigozhin, then they start trolling messages in favor of voting for Jill Stein in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And presumably the polling data was about those states. And lo and behold, Hillary Clinton loses those states by 77,000 votes. And Jill Stein got more votes than Hillary Clinton lost by. And that's just one aspect of the Russian activity. They attacked us on many fronts. So you have to hand it to them. They really did pull off something extraordinary here. I think it's, in intelligence terms, it probably is the greatest intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia.
I agree. I think this was an astounding, tremendous success for the Russians. They did, however, leave their fingerprints there for us to see. It's really a shame that all we had were these congressional inquiries, investigations from the intelligence committees and the Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as the Mueller investigation. It's a shame we didn't do what Joe Biden and I called for in our foreign affairs article almost 2 years ago now, where we called for a 9/11 style investigation, an independent commission that would have subpoena power and be able to look at the much broader scope of how Russia was able to interfere with our democracy in 2016. That didn't happen. So instead, we have to rely on these little nuggets from the Mueller investigation, which was much, as I said, narrower in scope. But there's still a lot there that suggests that, yes, there was active cooperation. I mean, what else do you call it when the chairman of Trump's campaign is sending polling data to a guy that the FBI themselves said was tied to the Russian military intelligence agency? well, I don't know what tied means to, other than he's an agent of that agency. And so, you know, this is sort of hiding in plain sight. It's really there in the Mueller report, and yet, you know, people haven't latched onto it because no criminal charges were brought.
But we know that the GRU, Russian military intelligence, were running the show, weren't they? I mean,
absolutely.
For example,
they were running the show. We've pinpointed with a great degree of accuracy the actual individuals within that agency, the GRU, who were responsible for hacking into the DCCC, the DNC, and Podesta's emails. And so we sort of know at least that piece of this operation, and we know the Internet Research Agency piece as well, and how it's a proxy organization funded by one of Putin's consiglieres. So we have the data. We just haven't put it all together into one narrative. And unfortunately, because Mueller's remit was to, you know, bring criminal charges when he felt was appropriate, we sort of narrowly focused on the criminal conspiracy aspects, which, as I said earlier, are very hard to prove when you're dealing with a sophisticated intelligence agency like the Russian military intelligence agency.
Well, just in closing, not to make Putin out to be 10 feet tall and the Russians are running rings around it. And in many ways, when you think about Brexit, I mean, the idea that Brexit, you could make the case that the United Kingdom was brought down by a Russian prostitute. This Russian prostitute was working for the FSB in the Emirates, trying to snare information from important people. She was kicked out of the Emirates. She shows up in London. Katya Perdita. She then marries ensnares Aaron Banks, an insurance guy. He's supposed to be a magnet, but he really wasn't. And lo and behold, £9 million of Russian money is funneled through her, through her husband, Aaron Banks, who's the biggest donor to the Leave campaign of Brexit. And as we know, Brexit has paralyzed the UK. They still don't know how to get out from under it. So I know I'm sort of...
That's right. And we know that Aaron Banks had something like 19 meetings with officials from the Russian embassy in London, including with officials who were known intelligence agents. And yet Brexit is on the course it's on.
Right. So, but just to finish up, though, at least in terms of in Mueller's indictments, and you mentioned the Russians that were named, the GRU officers, the way that they, I understand they got those names was that the Dutch intelligence had slaved a camera inside the Internet Research Agency where the GRU has a kind of booth, if you will, when people enter, they have to go through the metal detector and show their face and their pass to the camera where the GRU officer is sitting checking who they are, and all of that information went to the CIA. So it's at least the ledger is not entirely one-sided, that the Russians have won it all at every turn.
No, it's true. They're not 10 feet tall, and we, in fact, we've caught them in the act, and we have pretty much just about as much information as we really need to reach the obvious conclusion that they intervened and cooperated with a willing campaign in the United States and with certain willing individuals in Great Britain who were part of the Leave campaign. But unfortunately, we haven't taken the follow-on steps to both protect our institutions. Very little has been done on that front since 2016. And we haven't really imposed the costs on the Russians that we should have for an interference in our democratic process of the degree to which they perpetrated. And so that's the piece that's missing. It's not that they're 10 feet tall. It's just that our response has been incredibly lackluster.
Well, Dr. Michael Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who has previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. He's now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of a new book just out, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power.
from Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anna Merlin, a journalist specializing in politics, crime, religion, subcultures, and women's lives. She is a reporter at the Special Projects Desk, the investigative division of Gizmodo Media Group, and was previously a senior reporter at Jezebel and a staff writer at The Village Voice and The Dallas Observer. And she's the author of the new book just out, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anna Merlin.
Thank you for having me.
So in terms of the idea of the surprising rise of the power of American conspiracy theorists, we effectively have an American conspiracy theorist in chief in the Oval Office. A ban was put into place by Facebook on Thursday, banning those who engage in hate speech like Louis Farrakhan, Paul Nehlen, an anti-Semite who ran for Congress to take Paul Ryan's seat, and then, of course, Alex Jones, and also Paul Joseph Watson, Marla Yanalupas, and Laura Loomer were banned. But the president really complained about it, particularly...
He did.
Particularly Paul Joseph Watson, for some reason or other. He's a great fan of his. And this is a guy who has been pushing the theory of the DNC staffer, Seth Rich, being the source of the hack into the DNC, which was something that Julian Assange was pushing as well to distract from his culpability. And, of course, the old chestnut, the 9/11 conspiracy theorist and the chemtrails conspiracy theorist. So he's got the whole trifecta. So
yes.
What's your sense then of how we can deal with this issue when we have the most powerful person in the land, and perhaps in the world, unfortunately, being a fan of conspiracy theorists?
I think that Trump complaining so vociferously about these particular people being banned from Facebook was really noteworthy. In particular, Paul Joseph Watson, who is British, he's affiliated with InfoWars, and he is British, and so the idea that there was some, you know, vast American-centric conspiracy theory to take him off the air that Trump had to respond to is fascinating. But, I mean, I think what we're seeing with Trump's promotion of conspiracy theories and conspiratorial figures and far-right figures is that when someone as powerful as he is promotes these things, they have an impact. He's injecting these ideas directly into the mainstream, ideas that used to take years, you know, to work their way from the fringes inward are suddenly superpower. They suddenly make their way into the public discourse immediately, and that matters, and that has negative effects.
Well, he doesn't seem to understand, Trump, how the internet works, even though he's a big critic of big tech. And he did have the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, in the White House for a meeting a week or so ago, and he berated him about the fact that Trump's Twitter following has been reduced. And the reason it was reduced is that Twitter's been trying to get rid of the bots. So
yes,
there's clearly a massive relationship here between bots and the reach of these conspiracy theorists. What accounts for their popularity? How much of it is real and how much of it is manufactured by, for example, the Russians?
I think it's really, really hard to tell, but we do know that there have been bots manufactured by organizations like the Internet Research Agency that serve to promote conspiracy theories. But what we also know is that those agencies promote divisions that already existed in American life. For instance, there was a study in 2018 that found that some Russian bots that were active during the election now appear to be promoting both pro and anti-vaccine content. So the bots make the problem worse, but the bots also exploit weaknesses that were already present in American life.
Well, but that's Surkov, the so-called political technologist who's Putin's advisor on media and has created this condition in Russia, which has been written about in terms of nothing is true and everything is possible. And that's a part of the tactic, just to simply throw people off by supporting right-wingers one minute and then left-wingers the next. So that's consistent with that media strategy that Putin's developed. And here we have it in this country, a total divide between those in the Fox bubble who believe that everything else is fake news and those outside the Fox bubble who think that Fox is all fake news.
Yeah, I mean, overall, we are seeing a really wide division between how different groups of people interpret reality, and we're seeing sort of an increased cynicism about what is even knowable, what can possibly be fact-checked, you know, the nature of truth itself, which I argue in the book is also part of a strategy. It is politically expedient for politicians and for people in power if we are not sure about how to determine what is true and who is trustworthy, and if we sort of give up looking altogether. That only benefits people who are seeking power and political gain.
Well, but in the real world, intentions determine outcomes. And in conspiracy worlds, outcomes determine intentions. And it's fairly easy to do that. It's the old mafia expression, qui bono, you know, who benefits.
Right. Yeah.
That seems to be the sort of methodology. But you can't categorically prove that Elvis is not alive, even though it's pretty obvious that he's buried and you have to dig him up if it came to that. And you can't categorically prove that there are no UFOs at Area 51 in Nevada.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of things that we cannot categorically prove or disprove. And we also combine that in the United States with knowing that the government has engaged in a lot of genuine conspiracies. You know, when you refer to Area 51, the government didn't acknowledge Area 51 existed for a very, very, very long time. I think it was actually only publicly acknowledged in like 2008. I think that in this country we have, you know, an incredible sense that a lot of things have been hidden from us for a really long time, and it feeds into an atmosphere of suspicion and mistrust and just sort of a general lack of clarity about what is true and what is knowable, and that is a really disastrous state of affairs.
And again, I'm speaking with Anna Merlin, who is a journalist specializing in politics, crime, religion, subcultures, and women's lives. She's a reporter at the Specials Projects Desk, the investigative division of Gizmodo Media Group, and was previously a senior reporter at Jezebel and a staff writer at The Village Voice and The Dallas Observer. And she's the author of a new book just out, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. So what I think is really helpful about your book, and I've had a tendency to more or less dismiss conspiracy theorists as just annoying people who are muddying the waters and frustrating efforts to actually find out what is really going on in the world. But you take, I think, a more compassionate approach. And could you make the case that there's kind of a religious dimension to it? In other words, religion in many ways gives people comfort. It arranges all the unknowns in the world into a kind of a form that's digestible and comforting. Is that the case with conspiracy theories as well, that it's just a way for people to deal with a world that they can't handle?
Yeah, I tried to distinguish in the book between the way that politicians and people in power use conspiracy theories and the way that many ordinary people do, which is, as you say, to provide them with a sense of moral clarity, a sense of who they should be mad at, and a sense of a sort of set of guiding principles for how to understand the world, which unfortunately tend to be sort of negative guiding principles about who to blame and who to hold accountable and who to be angry at. But there is no question that conspiracy theories do serve a purpose for people in that way. They give them an outline of the world that makes more sense.
So in your research, to almost contradict what we've just been saying, you did interview some of the people that have been terrorizing the families of the children who were murdered at Sandy Hook, and they've developed this conspiracy theory that the whole thing was a government hoax, just like the 9/11 people believe that somehow the plane that hit the building was an Air Force plane or something, and that the real planes were landed at some undisclosed location, and the Passions was taken off and murdered by the U.S. government and buried in a mass grave. I mean, that's, you know, there's a ghoulish and disgusting, horrible, you know, I lost a friend in the first plane. So it just is, it's horrible that people do these things, and they're really horrible people. Alex Jones is a really horrible person. Is that?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Right.
And
you met with these people, how do they explain what they're doing? These people harassing these poor families who've lost their kids.
I mean, those people, particularly the sort of folks who believe that Sandy Hook was staged by what they call crisis actors, they avoid feeling empathy for the families by telling themselves that they are engaged in a hunt for a bigger truth, and that, you know, the families are a part of this architecture or mechanism that is very sinister, and so that they don't have to feel particularly bad about harassing them and making accusations and telling them to do really terrible things like exhume their children's bodies to prove that their children existed, something that many of these people have suggested many times. It is horrifying, and what is more horrifying is to know that these days any mass shooting, and we have so many of them in this country, is immediately attended by accusations that it was a false flag perpetrated by the government, perpetrated by crisis actors, and anyone who loses a loved one in a mass shooting or a mass casualty event usually is subject to accusations that their loved one didn't actually die, which is a scandal. It is disgusting. It is one of the worst conspiracy theories that this country is grappling with right now.
Well, I get confronted by the 9/11 truthers who just, you know, they come, well, they're not harassing me as much as they used to. They used to come to all of the events that I did at UCLA, you know, public events, and just try and foist their version of reality on. And I even had the CIA guy that was in charge of tracking bin Laden at there and gave them access to somebody who actually knew about what happened, knew who bin Laden was and what he was up to. And that still didn't get them off my back. And
No, it wouldn't.
Yeah, but the idea, though, that they believe that those buildings, those World Trade Center buildings, were somebody was able to put packages of C4 explosives and thousands of miles of det cord in order to mine those buildings, like they, you know, when they'd blow up skyscrapers to build a new casino in Las Vegas. It's a complicated business. You've got to use a lot of explosives and a lot of det cord. So let's assume that they were able to do that without anybody noticing, which is amazing that nobody, particularly when you think the head of the security at the World Trade Center was this former FBI guy who was the number one guy that understood what bin Laden was about and was trying to get this idiot Louis Free, the Opus Dei moron that was running the FBI, to pay attention to al-Qaeda, and he wasn't. He got so frustrated he left the FBI and became head of security at World Trade Center. So he would have certainly noticed thousands of miles of det cord and packages of C4 all over the basements of these two buildings. And then on top of that, if you were able to do that and have a scene like out of the Bridge on the River Kwai where some mysterious person plunges the plunger and the whole thing blows up, but you have to coordinate that with a plane flying in and then another plane. You know, it's like, why do you need the planes if you if you've already...
Yeah, a lot of conspiracy theories, the sort of exact mechanisms really, as you're pointing out, like, don't make sense. They don't work. I've always thought that it's more about creating a legible sort of moral map and pointing out the villain than it is about creating an actual coherent version of events, because that rarely works. There are a lot of sort of fractured narratives in the conspiracy world.
So we know why Alex Jones does it, because he makes money, right?
Yes.
That's it. But why does Trump do it? Why does he propagate conspiracy theories?
So I think that there are a couple of different answers to this. One is there's this book that I keep talking about a lot when I'm doing interviews, and it's called Fortress Russia, and it's about the way that conspiracy theories have been used in post-Soviet Russia to sort of aid Putin's rise to power. The reason why I talk about this book is that it is a really good example of seeing what Trump tries to do and fails. Conspiracy theories in the hands of the powerful in competent hands are a good way to coalesce your base, to point out the sort of outside enemy that everyone should rally against, and to encourage the public to give you as much power as you feel you need. Right? Conspiracy theories can be politically expedient and useful. So that's part of the reason why Trump does it. The other reason is that he has a tendency to promote anyone who is speaking positively of him, which is part of the reason why he was so upset earlier this week when all of these far-right figures and conspiracy theorists were banned from Facebook. It's not necessarily that he even knows a lot about what these people are claiming. It's that he knows that people like Paul Joseph Watson have praised him, and that is kind of, in some ways, where the matter ends for him. Anyone who speaks favorably of him has to be on his side, and anyone who doesn't is an enemy, and that's sort of like, that's as far as it goes. So I think Trump is doing a number of things. He's also somebody who's not particularly sophisticated about different forms of media and takes anything that Fox News says to be gospel truth, and so it predisposes him to promote sources of misinformation all the time, as long as those sources are positive towards him.
Well, Anna Merlin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, Anna Merlin is a journalist specializing in politics, crime, religion, subcultures, and women's lives. She's a reporter at the Special Projects Desk, the investigative division of Gizmodo Media Group, and was previously a senior reporter at Jezebel and a staff writer at The Village Voice and The Dallas Observer. And she's the author of a new book just out, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking at how the UK's Brexiteers seem to be ahead in the polls for the European Parliament elections, in which right-wing parties in Western Europe are trying to reach a one-third majority to paralyse the European Parliament. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He is the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And he's the author of Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain. And his latest book is Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Harold. And the European elections are on May the 23rd. And already the polls in the United Kingdom show that the Nigel Farage, who's behind the original Brexit campaign, the Leave campaign, his new Brexit party is running ahead of Labour and way ahead of the governing Conservatives. So what does that mean for these elections in coming up, as they say, on May the 23rd?
Well, I think, taking these latest poll numbers that you just cited on, at face value, it means an absolute disaster for the two major parties, particularly the Conservatives, and a real smashing victory for Nigel Farage and the Brexit forces. Of course, in 2014, when Farage was leading the UKIP party, that party came first with about 26% of the vote. So 30% is a very healthy share, and it's indicative of the broader malaise of the British party system.
But it's hard to understand how, for example, Farage is behind Brexit, which is getting out of the EU. Yet, even though UKIP, his party, sort of got wiped out in the British elections, he nevertheless got elected to the European Parliament, even though he hates the EU. He sits in the European Parliament, right?
Yes, he has and has done for a long time. Now, in 2000, in the most recent British elections, UKIP actually, polled a fairly a decent share of the vote, around 12 or 13% last time around. But their problem is for getting members elected is that their vote's very widely spread rather than being concentrated. And, of course, in a first-past-the-post electoral system, that is definitely not good news.
Well, it's still hard to understand why they're doing well in the European elections and not doing that well in the British elections. So can you clear that up for us?
Sure. I think so, because the European elections are what political scientists often call second-order elections, and people feel more free to focus on sort of hobby horses they have and so forth. But on this occasion, of course, there is one issue, and that issue is Brexit. And so the British electorate, it appears, has got about 25 to 30% of the people who are fairly hardcore Brexiteers. And of course, the Brexit Party is there for them in this context. In a broader general election, there are many other things that people are thinking about. Their long-term party loyalties in play in a way that they're not in play in a situation like this. So I think that goes a long way to explaining the clear success of Farage and his new party in this context.
So what about the rise of the pro-Remain Liberal Democrats and the new Change UK party? They're doing well. I can figure out the politics of the Liberal Democrats, but what's the politics of the Change UK party?
Well, if you take the sort of clear pro-Remain parties, which you mentioned two of them, Change UK and the long-established Liberal Democrats, along with the Greens and the SNP, they actually, if you total their vote, it's almost identical to what Brexit got. It's actually a little bit more. It's 31%. Now, the Change UK group are an interesting group of people. They are a moderate, in terms of their left-right ideology, or liberal conservatives, as we'd say here in the United States. They're very much moderates. And a lot of them came into politics in the Blair-Brown era. They're basically, in British terms, they'd be called Blairites. And they're the people who really are on the outs with Jeremy Corbyn and the current quite far left Labour leadership and the new Corbynista group in the party, and a number of them were afraid of actually being deselected and not chosen to run for Parliament again as a Labour candidate. And they're led by this guy Shaka Amuna, who you may know, who was described to the British press as probably a former leader, a future leader of Labour, the sort of Barack Obama of British politics. But with the new left-wing control of the party, he was very much in the outs. And so he went off, basically, and formed this new Change UK group. And in this context, again, they're doing very well. They're clearly very pro-Remain and took 9% of the vote in the most recent YouGov poll for the EU election, and so they're looking quite in good shape.
And again, I'm speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Dallas, Texas in Dallas. He's also the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor and author of Brexit: Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. So we know that. That Stephen Bannon has been working with all these right-wing nationalist parties in Europe to get them to a one-third majority or one-third minority vote in the European elections on May the 23rd, which would give them veto power and therefore paralyze the EU Parliament. And there's evidence that Putin has been slipping money into these parties. He's funded them for some time, like Alternative for Deutschland in Germany and Le Pen's party in France. So you can understand why Putin wants this paralysis, and I don't understand what Bannon's motives are. But obviously, he believes in white nationalism. So that's what's happening behind the scenes, if you will. But just to focus on the British situation, which we're talking about, just in the recent municipal local elections that took place in the UK, the Conservatives lost over 1,300 seats. And Labour is not doing well. It didn't gain anything. In fact, it lost a couple of seats. So
they lost 84, as a matter of fact.
They did.
Yes.
So they didn't get, they weren't bleeding quite as bad as the Conservatives. But you can see what's happening, that they're losing, the Conservatives are losing, and they've all but lost. So does that mean that these European elections on the May the 23rd, will that mean the end of Prime Minister May's government?
I think that, it's very hard to tell. These no one really knows. There's this toxic mix of policy and personal political ambition that makes it very hard to predict. But certainly there are open calls now for, have been for a while, but they've certainly been given a stronger voice by the local election results. I think it's very possible that May would be forced out. And of course, at that point, who knows what would happen? The government could easily lose a vote of confidence in Parliament. New elections would ensue. And it looks like the party system is very fragmented. In fact, there are some projections now that, based on the local election results, were they to translate to a general election, neither the Conservatives or Labour could even get 30% of the vote. And that would be the first time in history that such an event occurred. And this would be just absolutely chaotic.
So what is the fate then of the most logical way to get out of this paralysis, this zombie politics of the UK, having voted for Brexit with a bunch of liars like Farage and company, conning them into voting with all kinds of ridiculous lies, and it's clearly, the only person who's benefited so far has been Putin, who financed the Leave campaign via Aaron Banks. So at this point, the only thing that makes sense is a do-over, another referendum. And in the last parliamentary vote on a do-over, it failed by 11 votes. Why is there resistance amongst both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party to bite the bullet and do the logical thing, which is to have another election which will get rid of this ridiculous Brexit thing, and then they can, go back to normal?
Yes. Well, of course, the answer to that is there are a lot of people in the Conservative Party and a fair number in Labour as well who are in favor of Brexit. And you would be frightened to have another referendum. They wouldn't want to do this, even though it might provide, as you say, a pathway for finally resolving this sort of never-ending crisis. So I think that's just the simple answer. They say, oh, my goodness, we could lose. After all, they only won by about, 2% last time, 4%, 52-48. But it was a very closely fought thing. And it's clear that there's more enthusiasm for Remain now than there was before, so that Remain could well win. The polls are pretty uncertain, but nevertheless, it seems pretty clear that that's the case. And so, the answer is just that people who could lose don't want to take the chance. I think it's as simple as that.
Well, I've heard that just demographics will have indicated that a new vote to Remain would win, because the Leave voters who originally voted to leave under the first Brexit vote tend to be older, and the Remain people tend to be younger, and just simply by the fact that older voters are dying off and younger voters are coming onto the rolls, would indicate that a do-over vote to Remain would win. But nobody quite knows what to put on the actual referendum ballot itself, do they? Last time it was very simple. It was Leave and Remain. That's a no-brainer. You vote either to leave or to remain. What would the new vote be? What would the choice be?
Well, it's hard. It's again, all these things would be to negotiate, to be negotiated. But unless it was fairly, you know, fairly sharply defined, then it could lead to further, you know, very acrimonious and difficult politics. So there is an argument to be made that if they go ahead to do something like this, it's a pretty fair, you know, a clear cut kind of question, so that they, you know, there'd be no sort of backing and forthing afterwards. With regard to the age thing, it's interesting because that's sort of a two-edged sword. It's true the demographics in one sense, you know, favor remain. But on the other hand, young people historically don't come out to vote as much. Now, they may in this context, but historically they don't. So it's not quite as sharp as one might think. And also there's a divide amongst younger people between the sort of college types, those who really, you know, benefit from the membership in the European Union, and the non-college educated people who are more strongly Brexiteers, you know. So the youth are not a totally monolithic group in this regard.
But just in the last couple of minutes, back to the European elections on May the 23rd.
Yes.
It looks as though the two main parties in the UK are losing. We know the Conservatives lost 1,300 seats in the local elections.
Yes.
Labour lost 87. These new parties are emerging. I don't know whether the Change UK party is going to split the Labour Party, since it's a you know, defection from Labour.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a push. Yeah.
So then that doesn't bode well for the left, and the right seems to be paralysed. The Conservatives are just in complete disarray. So essentially what's going to happen is British politics are going to be even more fractured, less coherent?
Well, that's exactly, if you sort of step back and take it, you know, sort of the big picture look, what we're seeing, you know, pretty clearly is a fracture, continuous, a fragmentation of the British party system on a scale that we've never seen before. As I said earlier, there are projections by people like John Curtis, you know, a very prominent pollster, that should this continue, that neither party could even get 30% of the major parties could even get 30% of the vote in a general election. And I mean, that is really something. It would be a historic first. And so if you look at the poll right now, the most recent YouGov poll on the EU election, it's roughly a third, a third, and a third. A third for the Conservatives and Labour, a third for Brexit, and a third for these new parties, and plus the Liberal Democrats. So it's really an incredible situation.
Well, Harold Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Ian, and it's a pleasure, always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor, and the author of Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.